يقولون سلام سلام ولا هنا سلام.
You're listening to Middle East Analysis, a podcast series from the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales. Hello and welcome to another Middle East Analysis, an important one I would say after the events of the weekend just gone, 12th, 13th of February. Well, I'm joined by Dr. Harry Hagopian. How are you doing, Harry?
I'm fine, thank you, James.
Dr. Harry Hagopian, international lawyer and consultant to the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales. Bit of a crucial weekend in the Middle East, in particular in North Africa and Egypt. But before we look at Mubarak and the fact that he's stood down, let's look at how this all started, the context, why so many uprisings, if you like, have occurred in the region in such a short space of time. Why don't you take us back to Tunisia and what happened there?
Well, it's interesting, James, because this is really an epic moment for the whole Middle East, North Africa region. And I don't think many people realize that. I don't even realize it myself that after a century of basically quiet submission to the will of the regimes in those countries, suddenly the people, it seems like they've woken up and things are moving so fast that the term breaking news, which we constantly see on our television channels, for once applies, because it is really breaking news every minute, every day. And you're right. I mean, the initial spark that set off this whole movement, I think, began with Tunisia in early January, when a street vendor, his name is Mohamed Bouazizi, set himself on fire. And the reason he did that is because he got into an argument with a policewoman and he was so fed up of his life, no prospect, no money, no stability, that he went and set himself on fire. And that experience in self-immolation, that dramatic experience, basically, I think, was the first spark that set off the anger in Tunisia, and the people came out on the streets, not only to support him, but also to complain about their own socioeconomic problems and injustices and political oppression. And in a sense, we know what happened later. The Tunisian president had to abdicate and leave the country. And then after that, people started wondering where would it go next. And interestingly enough, there was another symbol or token of the uprising, like the one in Tunisia with Mohamed Bouazizi. This one was a chap by the name of Khalid Said, and Khalid Said was arrested by the Egyptian police, beaten, tortured, and then died. And he became the token for the Egyptian uprising. And usually in those sorts of spontaneous, unplanned uprisings, it takes an unexpected spark like this to set the whole thing on fire. And this is what happened. And we have seen time and time again in Liberation Square, in Tahrir Square in Cairo, the hundreds of thousands of people who came out demonstrating against the government, in all of Egypt, in Ismailiye, in Suez, in Alexandria, in Cairo, and other places. And initially, both in Tunisia and in Egypt, the regimes tried to campaign against this tide by using all sorts of methods, by using the police, which is a favorite tool for autocratic regimes, by using the media, which is usually submissive to the will of the regimes. But nothing worked. And eventually, as you said yourself in your intro, President Mubarak had to leave and pass on his powers first to his vice president and then to the High Military Council. And now, basically, what we are seeing are two countries who are in uncharted waters to some extent. And we're seeing this uprising going almost viral in the region and affecting other countries such as Algeria, such as Yemen, Bahrain, Sudan, even countries where you wouldn't expect this sort of thing to happen, like the Palestinian territories and Jordan.
Well, let's go back to the army generals that you hinted at there, the Egyptian army generals now technically running things. Might sound like an ignorant question, but after the people have stood up, they've got their way, if you like, mm-hmm. Can you have something of a vacuum? I mean, I know some of those generals were very sympathetic to Mubarak.
Well, a lot of those generals, James, were actually close friends of President Mubarak. And part of the worry is that would they be willing to go along with the huge masses of people who want dramatic change in the region? And what they have done in practical terms is already to dissolve the parliament, the two chambers, and parliament, the last elections were by any standard rigged elections, so parliament is no more. They have also, I think, abrogated the constitution, so the constitution is no longer there either. And the question is that they are thinking that they are going to be running the country for 6 months until fresh elections take place, fair and new elections, hopefully so that a civilian government, which encompasses all sectors of Egyptian society, basically come into power, both in parliament and then in government. And of course, some people might say, oh, we're going into the same territory of having the army run the country. But for the sake of stability at the moment, where there is a vacuum, where the uprisings were spontaneous and pretty much leaderless, run by younger generations, where there isn't that one charismatic politician who would be able to step in and basically get everybody together, I think it is acceptable to have the army in this transitional period. The worry is to make sure that that transitional period stays transitional, and in 6 months' time, the generals don't feel too comfortable in their chairs and perpetuate their rule, and it becomes a post-Mubarak period, but that we do have free and fair elections so that Egypt leads the way of the Arab world as it has done in the past four decades.
Now, my question would be, how do we avoid getting to this position in, say, 2040, give it another 30 years? Because I remember you telling me that President Mubarak was promising an end to poverty of his people. And, you know, is it not better the devil you know to an extent? Will it be better that he's gone?
No, I think it is better that he's gone, in all truth, because much as he provided the stability for the West, the country was suffering. I mean, Egypt had lost its prominence, the economic situation in the country had gone down, politically it had lost its clout, the oppression and the discrimination, the violation of human rights was ripe within the country. So in a sense, I think it's right that he's gone. But I agree with you, there is a little bit of a danger because we're so much in uncharted waters that we need to make sure that this goes the right way. But I would say that the fact that he served Western interests, the fact that he was an autocrat who basically made sure that the treaty with Israel stood the test of time, and that the oil was flowing through the Suez Canal, and that our Western interests were more or less supposedly secured with an autocrat like him, that is no reason for us as Westerners who believe in the fundamental freedoms that we have struggled for so long, that is no reason for us to say it's better the devil you know than the devil you don't. Because if you take this a little bit further, James, I would have an instinct to say, like any Westerner living in London, I would be much happier having somebody there who might be a little bit of an autocrat, but at least he's keeping the lid on things and he's defending Western interests. However, he's not, because this whole thesis that we have to support dictatorial regimes so that they provide us with the stability that we in the West need for our interests is not working. By supporting those regimes, we are actually fomenting Islamism and radicalism, and that is counterproductive to our own interests. And therefore, if we were a little bit less supportive of those autocratic regimes and more open to the will of the people, I don't think all Muslims are radical Islamists. And as the situation in Egypt has shown these people who have been on the in the streets in their hundreds of thousands, almost 1 point something million, they weren't there, all of them carrying the banner of Islam. These were secular people. I was struck by the fact that a lot of them who were being interviewed on our different channels and radio stations spoke with an American accent, and very fluently so. Which means to me that our whole idea of let's support autocracy for the sake of preventing Islamism has failed. And therefore, it's up to us in the West now to formulate a new policy that would deal with this reality that it is wrong to suppress a people and side with autocrats for the sake of an interest that doesn't actually materialize.
Let's take a quick look at the religious side of things quickly with regard to Egypt. I mean, the Muslim Brotherhood, for instance, appears to have been reasonably quiet throughout all of this. What do you think does come next? Do you think it's going to be a push for an Islamic government?
Well, that's another question that very many people in the West ask. And it's a very valid question, just as was the question about do we risk staying with Mubarak or not. But there again, I think the U.S. administration, which has been a very close ally to President Mubarak, who literally subsidizes the Egyptian military and the Egyptian army, they are realizing that their policies need some radical change in terms even of how they deal with Islamist parties. And the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt is a classic example. They were formed in 1928. Since the 50s, they've been officially banned, but unofficially the only opposition in town in Egypt. And everybody was worried that the minute Mubarak goes, they're going to come in and we're going to have an Iran. And we're going to be in a situation where we would have the same kind of stringent Islamist rule that would stifle out any freedom as we understand it in the West, and that it would moreover be an anti-West country. Well, let me give you another version. Why don't we also look at Turkey? Turkey is also run by an Islamist party. Erdogan, the prime minister, and Gül, the president, both come from very conservative Islamist parties. And yet we have a democracy in Turkey. We might not like it, but it is not only us who decide what happens in the Middle East. At the end of the day, the era of colonialism, as we've known it during the First and Second World Wars, is no longer there. We're in a new reality, and no less a person than our own Foreign Secretary, William Hague, said it when he basically said, it's a new reality, it's a new set of facts, we have to learn to deal with it, be it here in London or in the US or elsewhere. So much as the Muslim Brotherhood are a very, very integral part of Egyptian society, I wouldn't worry too much, because I would say if they represent something like 20-25% of the population of Egypt, then they have the right to be represented rather than forbidden from running for office or put in jails, because by doing that and by being associated with those authoritarian regimes, we in the West are no longer doing ourselves any service.
When you and I have talked about the place of the Christian minority communities, obviously you've mentioned with Egypt it being the largest Christian community in the Middle East. What do you think perhaps the Coptic Orthodox Church, what do you think they'll be thinking or analysing as they look on this situation?
It's instinctive, James, I think. And I know that a lot of what I'm saying today to many of your listeners might sound counterintuitive, or it might be something that is not very familiar to our Western ears or to our Western minds, in the sense that we automatically equate Islamism with radicalism and with anti-Western policies. It's inevitable that when undemocratic regimes are removed, we are worried that that would rebound on us in the West and on our own interests. Similarly, we are also conditioned to think, and we have reason to think, that if we do have Islamist regimes or pro-Muslim regimes, then they are going to impact also Christian minorities. Now, as you said, in Egypt, there is the largest Christian minority there. That's for sure. But I think that what the demonstrations showed in Tahrir Square is that Christians and Muslims, as grassroots populations, were both for change, and they were demonstrating together, side by side. And therefore, I would suggest that we give this change a chance to work. And the church has to realize that it is living and witnessing in a Muslim culture, in a predominantly Muslim culture, and we cannot expect Egypt to be London or to be any other country like Rome. It has its own set of facts, and we have to deal with those facts. One of them is that the church is a small community in a larger Muslim community. It has to learn to deal with those realities. Where do I put the line? I draw the line if there is any oppression or discrimination or persecution of Christians, be it in Egypt or anywhere else in the Middle East. That's when we have to speak out. And that's one of the mandates of the International Affairs Department of the Catholic Bishops' Conference here in England and Wales. I mean, Bishop Declan Lang, the chair of the department, and all the people working with him, we have constantly said that for us, it's not a question of changing cultures, regimes, political affiliations. For us, it's just standing in solidarity with the Christians of the Middle East, having that sense of universal fellowship that binds us together. And at the same time, when we go to countries like Lebanon, like Syria, like Egypt, those visits are not just to go there and see how things are. It is there to show a sign of solidarity, saying we're with you, even though your realities are different from our realities.
So, Harry, looking at what might happen next, I mean, you mentioned yourself that in practically a century, things have been reasonably quiet, and now it's a proper snowball effect. And we had over the weekend an Algerian pro-democracy rally. Things that we might have expected not to have been tolerated in the past. I think people are treading carefully here, the authorities. And then also we hear that the Palestinian Authority government has been dissolved ahead of a cabinet reshuffle. Put that in context for us a little bit.
Well, I'll put that in context, James, simply to say that, again, what is happening in the whole region is really epic. And we haven't realized that. I don't know what sort of a domino effect it would have. I don't know how fast the region as a whole might change or how slowly it might change. But things are happening. And the reason things are happening, if we go to the bottom line, it is basically because the ordinary citizen in any part of the Arab world has lost fear and is willing to stand up and say to his or her government, enough is enough, we need our rights, we demand our rights, and let's have democracy and good governance. In other words, they are basically claiming citizenship rights, which is something that they have been deprived of. You say they're a citizen of this country or that country, but the rights that are affiliated or associated with that citizenship have basically withered away. So they're asking for their citizenship rights, they're asking for their dignity and for their self-respect. And for any people that has the courage to stand up and say, I am not afraid anymore to speak out and I want to be respected just as any other ordinary human being is respected, that to me is the beginning of a whole fresh impetus for the region.
Well, I think also we stand at the beginning of a long-running story, Harry. So if you could come and update us when we've got some further analysis on this, I'd appreciate it.
With pleasure, James.
That's Dr. Harry Hagopian, international lawyer and consultant to the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales International Affairs Department.